May it please the court, Jennifer Fisher of counsel with the Fisher Law Firm, registration number 36590. By way of brief background in the case, this matter is before the court on an appeal. I represent appellant Denzel Marks, who was an aunt to the appellee nephew. In this matter, the case originates from a power of attorney that was given to her nephew back in February of 2007. It was the events subsequent to that power of attorney and his revocation that lead to the issues that are before the court here today. The power of attorney, which was originally given in February of 2007, continued by the nephew until about January of 2009, when some family relations raised issues in the case between the two parties. At that time, appellee nephew took the funds, cashed out CDs of appellant, and put those funds solely in an account in his name. At that time, my client was completely without access to those funds. Testimony at trial was that this was prompted by a concept of the nephew believing that my client needed a conservatorship, etc. But I will get to when the conservatorship claim was actually filed later down the road. The timeline in this case is very important. That happened in approximately January of 2009. In January of 2010, although there had been some talk about earlier revoking the power of attorney, my client does officially revoke the power of attorney of nephew appellee. She makes it clear at that time that she wants access back to her funds, and that's the first revocation of the power of attorney. Subsequent to that time, appellee does not return the funds. And even more so than not returning the funds, he makes use of those funds to pay attorney's fees for cases that happened at the trial court and the probate court and the underlying matters at this time. The trial court found that the amounts that were paid to attorneys, it was an approximate amount of $10,000, were a breach of his fiduciary duty and return and ordered the return of those funds to my clients. In doing so, the court also ordered approximately $2,000 in attorney's fees for my client having to bring action to recover those funds and deny the claim as to the penalties for early cashing out of the CDs. Those are the matters that we're here on today. I believe that the trial court erred in not giving the statutory penalties of civil theft on top of the $10,000 order that it made, and that the attorney's fees award is an abuse of discretion and that more attorney's fees should have been warranted.
Can I ask you a question about the facts? After the defendant transferred the funds into his personal account,
yes.
Did he pay the bills for Ms. Marks?
I believe he did. He also made some investments on her behalf.
Did he refuse any specific? I know she asked, at some point in time, she asked to have all the money returned. But in the meantime, did she say, gee, I need more money for a new refrigerator or a car or whatever? And did he respond to those requests?
I know there were some concerns about with respect to paying attorney's fees and down the line, but I don't believe that there were any denial of sort of living requests. I don't believe.
And those payments were made from the funds he had put into the separate account?
I don't know if the record reflects that, but okay. I don't believe that there was any conflict as to having her bills paid.
Okay.
Counsel, my understanding is that none of the Smart's funds, other than the $10,000 paid for attorney fees, was converted to the appellee's use. Am I correct in that?
Yes, however.
Well, but now let me ask my next part of the question.
Okay.
I know you have more you want to say about that.
Yes.
The trial court found there was no intent to permanently deprive Ms. Marks of her money. Given that he never used any of it for his own benefit other than the attorney fees, and that he never deprived her of the use of her money for paying her bills, how would you argue that there was evidence of his intent to steal?
Well, I think that you need to look at the two pieces separately. There was on about March 8th of 2011, there was about $235,000 in the fund of appellee. Approximately at that time, or I should say subsequent to that time, the $10,000 in payment to attorney's fees were made. And then ultimately, only about a month before trial, was the remaining $200,000 and change returned to my client. As to that remaining $200,000, I don't believe that there was a civil theft as to that, and we're not claiming that there was. The civil theft piece that we're looking for the statutory penalties on is only as to the $10,500 that were paid to the attorneys. So I think that there's some mixing of apples and oranges in that the trial court found that the constructive trust, there was no intent to deprive Ms. Marks of that money. And as to that piece, we're not arguing that there should be any civil theft or any statutory penalties as to the $200,000. With respect to the money that was paid to the attorneys, it's very clear that money was used to, or I should say the intent was to deprive Ms. Marks of that money. That money was used to pay his attorney's fees, in part to defend this lawsuit, to deprive her of all of her funds. And that goes into the attorney's fees piece of...
Another question.
Sure.
His attorney fees were incurred relative to the conservatorship, isn't that right?
In part, as to this litigation, and in part with respect to the conservatorship and the probate.
And I believe the record reflected that an attorney advised him that was appropriate for him to use her funds in that way. Is that not also true?
I believe he said that his basis of thinking that it was okay to use the money was because of advice of counsel.
Then how do you argue again that is an intent to steal when he used the money in that way? Can you address that?
I believe that it was at that time, the record is clear, and counsel's sort of advice aside, it was clear that the power of attorney had been revoked at that time. There was no conservatorship in place in which he was a part of. There, idea of the conservatorship is a little bit of a red herring in this case. The testimony was in January of 2009, that the funds were taken and cashed out of the CD because he thought a conservatorship was forthcoming or that it was necessary. But that's belied by the fact that it's never actually filed until this action is brought as a counterclaim. So there's a significant length of time in there, which shows that the appellee was aware of how he could have gone about properly being reimbursed and properly protecting the estate and Ms. Marks, but that's not actually what happened. Instead, it was a unilateral action of taking her money from an account which she had access to and moving it into an account that only he had access to. And then at that time, you know, ignoring the revocation of power of attorney, ignoring her request for returns of the funds. At trial, Dr. Kay testified that she was in control of her mental faculties, that a conservatorship or guardianship was not something that was necessary in this case. So the actions of appellee were based on his own idea of the circumstances without actually going through the proper channels to accomplish it.
Well, Ms. Fisher, let me ask you this. With regard to the $10,000 and the civil theft, what needs to be shown is that defendant knowingly obtained control over the aunt's property without authorization. And so the question as to without authorization, I understand you're saying that there was a revocation of the power of attorney, but also you have the defendant stating that another attorney told him it was okay to do that. So is that disputed evidence, and it's up to the court to resolve that dispute?
I don't believe that's the case because I do think that the credibility is within the province of the trial court. I think that the idea here is that even if an attorney had told him that you can be compensated in this way, that there was no basis for compensation here. There was no power of attorney, as I stated before, it had been revoked. There was no conservatorship. The intent, that use of that money was solely for the purpose of the nephew of appellee in this instance. It served no benefit to appellant in any way. In fact, it was used to her detriment. The other piece that is up on appeal is the attorney's fees piece, in which we believe the trial court abused its discretion in only awarding $2,000. The trial court reduced the attorney's fees for several reasons. In one, the trial court said summary pleadings could have been filed. The trial court ignores that in this instance, two summary pleadings were filed, a motion for judgment on the pleadings and a motion for partial summary judgment, both of which were denied by the trial court.
Did either of those motions focus on the $10,000?
At that time, the $200,000 had not been the remaining $200,000 had not been returned, so they were focused on the whole. Which brings me to my next point, is there's the trial court touched on it, as says appellee, that plaintiff only won a small percentage of what they were seeking. Because defendant, a month before trial, returned the $200,000 and made it a moot issue. If that had been, that was not part of what the trial court was anticipating. So the reduction in what the plaintiffs won from what they were seeking was not because they put on evidence of all of the full $235,000, but the court only awarded $10,000. The defendants mooted part of that issue by returning those funds prior to trial. It wasn't until after hearing an accounting in this matter that some claims could be dropped, and that was primarily with the issue of the loan, whether it had been repaid properly. Plaintiffs in the first part of the case did not know that that was a resolved issue. So some of the attorney's fees incurred in this were because of defendant's actions.
Counsel, when the defendant withdrew the funds and incurred the penalties, was he acting as a trustee at that point in time?
At that point, the power of attorney had not been revoked, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
It was subsequent thereafter that my client got counsel involved to try to start the process of trying to recover those funds.
When was the power of attorney actually revoked? It was July, wasn't it?
In July, the issue first arose in July of 2009 when my client first obtained counsel. There was some communications that after my client was met with the doctor, if the doctor determined that she was able to take care of her own matters, that he would willingly give up his power of attorney. The power of attorney wasn't formally revoked until January 14th of 2010. I'm going to save my last few minutes for rebuttal.
You have 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Jared Balson, registration number 28532, appearing on behalf of Kelly Krueger in this case. Well, I'd like to first answer a question that you asked about when the attorney fee payments were made in relation to the revocation. The revocation, as stated, occurred on January 14, 2010. The first payment of attorney's fees was March 4, 2009, prior to that revocation. The second payment of attorney's fees was March 11, 2011, which would have been post-revocation. And the third payment was June 27, 2011, again post-revocation. But with regard to the issue of theft, some of your other questions are certainly important to that. Client did testify that he consulted with his attorney after the stipulations in the probate cases. The conservatorship and a guardianship were entered. And after that, counsel was consulted, and apparently the end result of that is that my client believed that he was authorized to make that last payment, again on June 27, 2011. However,
when was the conservatorship order actually entered?
The record as it stands on appeal is not clear about that. Part of the problem is the exhibits were not entered into the record. So the stipulation was approximately June 17th, 2011, as best can be determined from the record, and I'm using page 440 from the record to get that information. That's one of the statements in one of the pleadings filed. that was occurring about that time.
Is it in the record when the consultation with the attorney took place?
It is not. That question was not asked, and that information was not offered in response to the question on page 157 of the supplemental transcripts that were entered, day one transcript. Again, bottom of page 156, top of 157 is where that issue was addressed. However, again, with regard to the theft, if he's authorized to reimburse himself for his expenses he incurred while acting as agent, even after revocation, he's reimbursing himself for his good faith acts. So he acted in good faith. And the trial court went through great pains to set those facts out because it was part of the complaint filed in this case. Their breach of fiduciary duty claim, one of four, one was he breached his duty by not acting in good faith. That was a big part of their allegations in this case. And as you read the court's findings and order, the trial court, after hearing my client testify, after hearing Denzel Marks testify, after hearing the other people involved in the case testify, the trial court, in the sufficiency of the evidence issue, weighing the credibility of the evidence and assigning weight to the testimony of the various parties, he believed and trusted quite clearly my client that was acting in good faith. So their complaint said he acted in bad faith. Trial court found no. And once the trial court accepted that he was acting in good faith throughout the handling of these monies, it's very easy to say at that point, well, then he can't be guilty of theft. If he's acting in good faith, he believes she's incompetent. Now, the court disagreed with that, but the court also found that there was a good reason to believe that she was going to throw away her money to allow her elderly friend to waste the assets of her estate. So my client protected the funds by withdrawing them when his power of attorney was effective. But he didn't need the power of attorney to do that because he was a joint account holder already on those accounts. She, Denzel Marks, set the account up as a joint account with both my client, Kelly Krueger, and his sister, Kathleen Adderhold. So all three were parties to the account. He could have withdrawn those funds at any point.
Well, going back to the civil theft, I understand you're saying he was acting in good faith, but going back to the civil theft, you have to show that defendant knowingly obtained control over Ann's property without authorization. And what is the evidence of authorization?
Authorization. It depends upon the payment, what payment was made when, for example. And so the first payment, March 9, 2009. Again, the power of attorney is effective at that point. And our power of attorney statute says that agents are entitled to reimbursement. It doesn't say you have to go to court and get approval first. It's a self-executing process. Now, later, if the principal believes that you shouldn't have paid yourself and it wasn't a reasonable expense and it wasn't reasonably incurred, then they can sue to recover those funds. But there's nothing in our statute that specifically says you're entitled to reimbursement for reasonably incurred expenses. So, again, under the power of attorney theory that was in effect at the time, and he was, the power of attorney was there, although he didn't need it to withdraw the funds. But for making the payment,
to withdraw the funds because he was on the account, you're saying.
He was on the account. So he had two ways of accessing the money, as an account holder and as agent under power of attorney. So again, that first payment, $669. The second payment, what was the authorization for a second payment on March 11th, 2011? That's roughly $2,600. At that point, the revocation had occurred. However, the statute hasn't changed. The statute says if you've incurred expenses reasonably related to your duties, you're entitled to reimbursement. He's in the process of defending himself, acting in good faith to protect her estate. The fees that he's incurring as part of the litigation that is this case is to defend his reasonable actions. The fees that he's incurring, he and his sister both, he's paying for the conservatorship and guardianship cases in Denver, the Denver probate cases. Again, he's incurring those because he believes in good faith, as the trial court found, that she needed assistance. She needed some help. So that's what Kelly Krueger believed in good faith. So he's incurring those expenses reasonably related to protecting her estate, which is one of the things he's required to do as agent under power of attorney.
At that point,
yes.
he what The power of attorney had been revoked. Was he still on the account?
At that point, by the time he made the second payment on March 11th, the joint status of the CDs would not have been in effect because he closed those.
He already had his own account, yeah.
He liquidated and put them in.
So what basis did he have for holding the entire quantity? What authority did he have to hold the entire $200,000?
His good faith belief that he was protecting her assets from herself. So one of the pulls in this case, one of the conflicts is, if you have a principal that says, give me my money, but the agent says, I think you're incompetent. I don't think...
But he's not an agent anymore.
At the time she was requesting her money, and then as a constructive trustee, depends on at what point in time you're looking at the scenario.
I was looking at the time of the second payment.
March 11th, okay, so he's no longer, he's a constructive trustee at that point, okay? But he still has the obligation as a trustee to look after those assets for her benefit, to act in her best interests. And it's not in her best interest to turn the money over to her if, in good faith, you believe that when she does that, she's going to give the money to her friend, who's 91, was a CPA many, many years ago, and doesn't understand the current regulations, and looks like he's going to invest in stock-based mutual funds in the middle of the Great Recession. The trial court says, objectively, no one would have given her advice at that time, like he was giving her. It was surely going to do away with all of her funds. So his actions protected her estate, not for his benefit, but for her benefit. She has those funds today because he would not turn those funds over to her, to stop her from turning them over to her elderly friend. So his authority was acting in her best interest. And as constructive trustee, then he's got an obligation still to look after her benefit. But going back to the issue in this case is, what is their appeal about with regard to the theft issue? They raise the issue as a matter of law, we're entitled to a directed verdict, essentially. And the Rosen case says, if you don't make your motion at the trial court for a directed verdict or judgment notwithstanding the verdict, then you have not preserved the issue on appeal. You cannot raise the fact that you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. You've waived the issue. I think the Rosen case clearly applies in this case. So, and you can see that, one, they use the language, we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. It's pretty clear that that's what they mean. But in their standard of review, they use a legal standard, a de novo standard. So again, they're not attacking the facts. They're not saying the facts as found by the trial court were clearly erroneous. In fact, what they're trying to say is, my client confessed to theft because they're not taking into account the culpable mental state required, like authorization, knowingly without authorization. So when you look at their request for directing the verdict notwithstanding the judgment, Rosen says they didn't preserve it because there's no post-trial motion for directed verdict. If they get past Rosen somehow, then you have the sufficiency of the sufficiency of the evidence questions. On one hand, Rule 10B, Colorado Appellate Rule 10B, says if you're attacking the sufficiency of the evidence, you have the sole obligation of putting into evidence everything that factored into that decision. In this case, even after their motion to correct the record and add the second day of trial, they still have not added the exhibits in this case. And under the North Star opinion from the Supreme Court, they haven't included the exhibits, but they're now, as part of their reply brief, trying to attack as clearly erroneous the facts with regard to theft, which they can't do for the first time, right? So if they were trying to attack the sufficiency of the evidence, there's no indication of it, but if they're trying to, then they should have put the exhibits into the record, and they did not. And for that reason, again, this case should be dismissed under the North Star opinion.
Well, let me ask you this. If you agree, or if we were to agree that this was a challenge to sufficiency, we would be reviewing de novo and reviewing for clear error. I mean, what standard would we be reviewing?
De novo is the legal standard for facts. It's right. Clearly erroneous. Right. So if they're trying to attack the sufficiency of the evidence, the question is there support in the record? And there's lots of support in the record that he did not intend to steal. One, his own testimony, of course. I did not. Now, the plaintiffs in this case say, well, the court should not believe him. It's a self-serving statement. the weight and credibility decisions about anybody's testimony goes to the trial court. And the trial court very clearly in this case believed that my client acted in good faith because he thought she was about to waste her estate. He never had the intent to steal. There's plenty of support in the record for those findings. But so if they're attacking sufficiency of the evidence, they didn't put the exhibits in, so therefore they should...
Which of the exhibits do you think would have been relevant to this argument on civil theft?
One, the power of attorney, exhibit one. Because our statute says, unless the power of attorney says otherwise, you're entitled to reimbursement. Now, what does the power of attorney say in this case? It's not admitted, well, it was admitted at trial. It's not part of the trial record. Not part of the trial record. The letters having to do with revocation. I think they're 10, 11, and 12. When was what revoked? When was the power of attorney revoked? We agree it was in January 2010. But those, when my client got information about that revocation process, those are from those letters. They're not part of the trial court record. I mean, excuse me, the appellate record. Now, if they're not attacking the sufficiency of the evidence with regard to theft, then they're stuck with the facts from the trial court. Because this court, if there's no challenge, this court can't overturn them. The trial court made a determination of fact. Kelly Krueger never had the intent to steal. So if they're not challenging sufficiency of the evidence because they want to get away from the dismissal for not including the exhibits, for example, well, then we're not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence. Well, then you're stuck with the facts. And if the trial court's fact that you're stuck with is he never had the intent to steal, he can never, ever, under any theory, be convicted of theft. They've only challenged under theft 1A, not under the other theories. So if there's no intent to permanently deprive, there's no theft in this case. So they've got, they have to make a choice about which avenue their appeal is proceeding under, and it can't come from their reply brief. It can't, at the reply brief, suddenly say, well, now we're challenging clearly erroneous facts, and so, you know, we should be good going forward with the case. With regard to the attorney fee issue, the court exercised its discretion. The court looked at all the claims that were filed, and the, for example, theft of the entire estate. No, he accounted for all of it. He had all the records. The court looked at the benefits gained, the expenses used. The court gave them 5% of their fees, which was 5% of what they recovered from their claim. Roughly $11,000 recovered, and the allegation was a theft of $250,000, for example. So again, right at right at 5%. But my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Fisher?
If I may, I'd like to address some of the points that counsel makes. The first is this concept of entitlement to reimbursement for work performed under the power of attorney. The idea just is illogical in that the court didn't find that the trustee, our appellee in this instance, was entitled to reimbursement. The court ordered the return of the funds. In doing so, and it goes to the issue of intent, the court finds that states, I'm having a lot of difficulty understanding any justification for why he used the attorney's fees. That cuts against, one, any concept that he was entitled to reimbursement. It also cuts against this concept that there was no intent. The pleadings or the reply, the briefs in this matter have been on a basis of, well, the court found that there is no intent to steal, and arguably the court does make that statement in its findings. But the appellate court must also look at the whole of those findings of fact, where the court finds no justification for the appellee's payment of those attorney's fees.
Counsel, I'm having trouble following all this argument. Are you asserting that you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the claim for civil theft, or are you challenging the sufficiency of the findings?
We're challenging the sufficiency of the findings. I'll concede to opposing counsel that the language is imprecise, and I understand why he sort of takes that clause out of the briefing, but the issue is cited as an abuse of discretion. Issue number one is, I'll tell you.
How can we decide that issue if we don't have the entire record before us?
I believe that all the pieces relevant are relevant to the decision are in the finding of fact. The issue that appellee raises is a question of whether the power of attorney when it was revoked, but the court has already found that that was on the January date that we've been discussing here.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted and we'll render a decision in due course.